Darkcast Network. Welcome to the dark side of podcasting.
In the early morning hours of February 14th, 2000, 9-year-old Aisha Degree took her backpack and slipped out of her house. Several motorists later reported seeing her walking alone in a rainstorm at around 4 a.m. Where was she going? What or who made her leave home that night? Over the next 24 years, Aisha Degree's disappearance would not only confound the small town of Shelby, North Carolina, where she was from, but the world as well. Her story has been the subject of countless blogs, internet forums, YouTube videos, and podcasts. People have become obsessed with getting answers. What made this 9-year-old girl leave her house in the middle of the night, and what happened to her after that? In September 2024, we finally got some potential answers to the second question after a series of search warrants were executed at various properties in North Carolina. While we still may not know what caused Aisha to leave that night, investigators now believe that they have the names of some of the people who were involved in her disappearance. When a person goes missing, there's a special kind of pain in the not knowing. I want to tell you the stories of those who never came home. Today, I want to update you on the story of Aisha Degree. I'm Kona Gallagher.
And I'm Ethan Flick.
And this is And Then They Were Gone. Welcome back, everyone.
Welcome back.
Thank you for joining us once again. I'm Kona.
And I'm Ethan.
And we're the husband and wife team behind this podcast. Each week, I tell you the story of an unsolved missing persons case. Ethan doesn't know anything about the case going into the episode, and he's here to provide his reactions and questions in real time, hopefully asking some of the same ones you have at home. Aisha Degree's case is one of the ones that always gets brought up when someone asks, you know, like, what's the one case you want to see solved? She came from a stable family and didn't have any of the warning signs of a runaway. I mean, plus, at 9 years old, she was so much younger than the age of the average runaway child. So when we heard a few weeks back that the police had named suspects in her case, it shook the true crime world. While we did learn a lot based on the search warrants that the Cleveland County Sheriff's Department executed, like everything else in this case, it leaves us with even more questions. I was able to get a hold of the search warrant applications, improbable cause affidavits, and the list of what was seized. So this week, we're going to discuss what we've learned from these searches and who could be involved in Aisha's disappearance. Now, 2 weeks ago, we did a mini update on this case when the news first broke about the searches. And so if you're unfamiliar with Aisha's story, you can scroll back to our September 13th, 2024 episode, which is just two episodes below this one, and listen to the entire story to get all caught up. So are you ready? Like, I mean, because this is different since it's an update. You obviously know Aisha's story, and we've talked a little bit about the searches and stuff that have been going on.
Yeah, I mean, I'm curious to see or to hear what was in the search warrant and like what was actually seized.
Yeah, so I have the whole lists. There were 7 search warrants in total. They have a lot of evidence now that they need to sift through. Obviously, we don't have any arrests or anything yet, but
at least not at this point.
Yeah, at the time of this recording. But there's certainly a lot going on with this case. So let's talk about it. But before we get started, I'll just do a quick recap of her disappearance. Aisha Degree was 9 years old in 2000, and she was in the fourth grade. She was also a star basketball player and played point guard for her team at Falston Elementary School. The weekend of Valentine's Day 2000 was a 3-day weekend for Aisha and her brother, with school being closed on Friday, February 11th. That day, her parents, Harold and Aquilis, still had to work, so Aisha and her brother, O'Brien, spent the day at their cousin Keisha's house. And she lived in the same neighborhood. Like, a lot of their family lived in that neighborhood. Both Aisha and O'Brien had basketball practice at their school, which they attended. Then that Saturday evening, Aisha had a sleepover with a dozen of her cousins. And the sleepover was hosted by her 15-year-old cousin, Katina DeGree. Chanel DeGree, another one of Aisha's cousins who was at the slumber party, said that Aisha was happy that night and was dancing and laughing along with everyone else. And, you know, she did have a basketball game earlier that day, which she got fouled out of and right. was upset. But everybody said she was fine by the end of it.
Yeah.
The next day, the family attended church at Macedonia Missionary Baptist Church, followed by lunch at an aunt's house. Later that evening, however, Aisha seemed tired, which she had to have that sleepover the night before in a basketball game, so that makes sense. And she also complained of having a headache and went to bed early at around 6:30, according to Harold. But then they had a huge storm that rolled in that night, and the thunder and lightning woke Aisha up, so she rejoined the family in the den, and they were all watching TV. So then it was like icy, and so there was a car accident nearby, and the car hit an electric pole, and that caused the power to go out. This was like around 9 o'clock, so Harold and Aquila sent the kids to bed. And then, according to an interview that he gave, Harold went to sleep around 12:30 and said that he checked on Aisha and O'Brien, who shared a room, and saw that they were both in bed sleeping. But at some point during the night, O'Brien thinks it was around 2:30, but, you know, he can't be sure. He says that Aisha got up to use the restroom. She did come back, and then he fell back asleep. Now, the next morning was Valentine's Day, which was also Harold and Aquila's anniversary. Aquila says that she woke up at 5:45 a.m. and went in to wake the kids up for school at about 6:30, and that's when she saw that Aisha was not in her bed. So she, you know, went out, called for Aisha, looked around the house, obviously, couldn't find her, called the police. The police got there at about 7 o'clock. Neighbors and family came out to search for her as well. And by noon, they had a helicopter with infrared searching the area. And there was a huge ground search that happened and went on for the next 2 weeks. Then the tips started to come in. So first, two motorists called in and said that they believed they had seen Aisha walking on the side of North Carolina State Route 18, which is also Falston Road, between 3:30 and 4:15 a.m. Jeff Roop, one of the people who called that in, told reporters on the 17th that he saw a little girl walking on the side of the road around 4 a.m. on Monday morning. He told reporters, quote, "I seen a little girl walking down the road with her book bag. She had on a little dress and white tennis shoes, and her hair was in pigtails. I went back, but she never did look up at me. She looked like she knew where she was going. She was walking at a pretty good pace," end quote. Other witnesses were Roy Blanton Sr. and his son, Roy Jr. They were on a trucking run heading north on NC-18 when they saw someone walking south at around 4:30. So despite these tips and, you know, then there was like a shed that they found some items that they thought could belong to her. You know, there's a lot going on, but ultimately nothing huge was found. And then after a couple of weeks, the ground search was suspended. Then in August 2001, so almost a year and a half later, construction workers were grading a path for a driveway in Burke County, about 25 miles away on NC 18 South, the road on which Aisha was last seen, when they made a shocking discovery. They uncovered a double-wrapped plastic bag, inside of which was a black backpack with Aisha's name on it. Then, in 2016, the FBI publicized a tip that they had received. Someone matching Aisha's description was seen getting into a car on Highway 18 around the area where she was last seen. The vehicle was described as an early 1970s Lincoln Mark IV or a Ford Thunderbird with rust around the wheel wells. Then 2 years later, in 2018, the sheriff's office released some information about two of the items found in Aisha's book bag back in 2001. A copy of Dr. Seuss's McGillicuddy's Pool, and a New Kids on the Block concert t-shirt that did not belong to Aisha. Now, the library book was from Aisha's school library, but it doesn't seem as though it was checked out by her. Then in 2022, Aquila told News Nation that Aisha's basketball uniform was also inside the backpack, which is information that was never released by law enforcement. And when I wrote our original episode on this, I didn't even mention the basketball uniform because I couldn't find the original source for the information. But I did find the News Nation article while working on this episode. Aquila's revelation about the basketball uniform is a huge one to me. Because, like, to me, it shows that Aisha wasn't planning on leaving for good.
Right.
Or, you know, even leaving the area. She packed her bag with things she would need for a few days, maybe, or maybe even just overnight.
Right. And if they had school on Monday, then it's probably pretty safe to assume she had practice on Monday, too.
Yeah, probably. Right.
Which and is so probably why she packed her school uniform or her basketball uniform.
Yeah. So she's just packing a few things that she needed. And so it seems like she was planning on going somewhere, but like was just going there short term and then was going to resume her life as normal.
Yeah, I mean, all signs are pointing that way. But even so, like, where was she going?
No, I know. I know. I mean, honestly, and in a rainstorm, like with no coat and yeah. in the middle of the night, and she's 9 years old and like a very sheltered 9 year old.
Yeah,
at that.
And you can't even like chalk it up to sleepwalking because, you know, just she's out on the street. There's cold air.
Yeah.
Rain hitting her face. You know, like it's at some point she would have woken up.
Exactly. But sleepwalking is a big theory that people have been bandying about. And we actually had a sleepwalking incident a couple of nights ago with one of our kids. That is something that we do have experience with children sleepwalking.
Yes. Several of our children.
Yeah. And we have had one of them years ago go outside in a sleepwalking situation. But once somebody got to him, you know, he woke up and was fine. Kids can definitely like get up and leave the house for sure.
Yeah.
But getting up, leaving the house, or getting up, packing a book bag, leaving the house.
It's the
packing it with like specific things that you need.
Yeah. That to me is it just that doesn't seem like sleepwalking behavior, you know?
Yeah.
So planned and thought out.
Mm-hmm.
Unless that was like part of a normal routine for her. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And it could have been. But I mean, she packed other clothes in yeah. addition to the basketball uniform. So that wouldn't be routine, I wouldn't think. You know, I think it would be normal for her to potentially put her basketball uniform in the backpack. But
yeah, I mean, unless it was routine for her to also pack a change of clothes
yeah.
for after practice. But we don't know.
But the key with the sleepwalking thing, too, is that the DeGree family has never said that Aisha has ever sleptwalked before. And that incident that we were talking about with our kid when he left the house and it was really terrifying, that was not the first time.
Right.
Like it had been kind of like escalating almost.
Yeah.
Because usually they just kind of get up and they go into the hallway or
run into a wall and start screaming.
Yes, that was one thing that happened as well. The sleepwalking thing has always seemed a little far-fetched to me.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree. Again, especially once you get outside, there are other factors that...
Yeah, and the rain and hitting the cars her face. Going by and yeah. like, yeah.
I feel like she would have, you know, kind of, I don't want to say woke up, but kind of snapped out of it or came yeah. to or however you want to put it, and probably realized that she wasn't where she was supposed to be and made her way back home.
Right. So the reason that she left her house is still a giant mystery, and it becomes even more mysterious once you take into account what police have just uncovered.
Did you know that your actual age might not be the same as your biological age? That's right. It's not just about your birth date. Your body could be older or younger than you think. Hey everyone, it's Kona, host of And Then They Were Gone, and I am coming to you today to talk about True Diagnostic. With their True Age test, you can discover your true biological age, plus get insights into things like your risk for heart disease, Alzheimer's, and even early mortality. And the best part? It's all done from the comfort of your own home. No prescriptions, no lab visits, just a simple test sent straight to your door. True Age is actually sending me a test, and I'm really excited to see what it's going to say about my health. And frankly, a little frightened. Because even though I'm afraid it's going to tell me that my biological age is higher than my normal age, it's definitely information that I can use. Because by tracking my biological age, I can actually see how changes that I make, whether exercise, diet, or sleep, can affect my health over time. And this isn't guesswork. The True Age test is based on peer-reviewed research from scientists working with Harvard, Duke, and Yale. I don't know. I like to know everything, so I think it's going to be really cool to know exactly how my lifestyle is impacting my body. I already know there's definitely room for improvement, and I think this is going to give me some actionable steps. So if you're ready to join me and find out your biological age, right now, my listeners can get 20% off their entire order at truediagnostic.com by using the code ATTWG at checkout. That's True Diagnostic. truediagnostic.com. Just use the code ATTWG to save 20%. Plus, if you subscribe, you'll get an additional 20% off the 50% discount. Discover your true age today. On September 10th and 11th, 2024, Cleveland County Sheriffs, along with the North Carolina State Bureau of Investigation and the FBI, executed a series of search warrants aimed at one Shelby family, the Deadmans. We first heard about these search warrants as they were being executed, but before the warrant applications were made public. The first huge bit of information that we got was when news cameras caught a green car being towed away from 601 Cherryville Road, a property less than 4 miles from where Aisha was last seen. The green car, while not a 1970s Lincoln Mark IV or a Ford Thunderbird, was similar. It turned out to be a 1964 AMC Rambler that had front end damage. And this was huge because police at this point weren't even saying why they were searching these properties or what case it was related to. But as soon as that green car showed up on the tow truck, like, even the news reporters were like, this is definitely Aisha's case.
Yeah.
Because that green car has been just such a big part of the story for the last several years. So police are being very tight-lipped about what they were looking for and what was found. But, you know, that car was kind of hard to miss. The internet exploded. And on September 11th, the Cleveland County Sheriff's Department released the following statement. Quote, "The Cleveland County Sheriff's Office, the FBI, and the SBI are currently executing a court-authorized search warrant at a property on Cherryville Road in Shelby. Cleveland County deputies, the FBI's evidence response team, and SBI agents, including specially trained canines, arrived this morning and will likely be on the scene for most of the day. The search warrants are not publicly available at this time. More information will be released when appropriate." End quote. So the rumor mill started going crazy because, like I said, I mean, this case is just huge in the true crime community and, of course, in the town of Shelby as well. So people started making like TikToks and things saying that the owner of the house had made a deathbed confession, that he said he had killed Aisha and that they found Aisha's body on the property.
Right, which is all made up, right?
Oh, yeah, I mean, completely. And so, like, I remember... So,
like, where are these people pulling this from? Like, they're just saying,
like,
things?
Oh, yeah, they're like, oh, my friend's dad works at, you know, wherever and heard that blah, 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 okay. You know, stuff like that.
Yeah.
So there were so many people making wild speculations and accusations that 2 days later, on the 13th, the Sheriff's Department released a follow-up press release that said, quote, "The search warrants executed this week by the Cleveland County Sheriff's Office, the FBI, and the SBI are related to the disappearance of Aisha Degree. The search warrants were obtained based on physical evidence directly connected to Aisha's disappearance. Multiple items of interest were taken from the sites and will be analyzed. It is important to dispel rumors circulating about the investigation. No human remains were recovered. Again, no human remains were found. This investigation is ongoing and official information will be released by the Cleveland County Sheriff's Office when appropriate. Please do not spread rumors on social media out of respect for Aisha's family and this investigation. Thank you, Sheriff Alan Norman."
Very pointed.
Yeah. And like, he signed it. Like, you know what I mean? He did. Yeah. There was no "thank you, Sheriff Alan Norman" on the first press release.
Yeah.
But on the second, like, he was tired. You could tell.
Yeah.
So that same day, on September 13th, Roy Deadman's lawyer held an interesting press conference.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. And it's funny because I made a TikTok video not making accusations, but covering this press conference. And I had looked at property records. So I'd already found the owners of the sites that were being searched, but I wasn't going to like name the person at all.
Yeah.
But then his lawyer's like, I represent a client, Roy Dedman, who owns this property, and he's being accused of, you know, and I was like, well, shit, if his lawyer's going to get up and hold a press conference, I guess it's fair game.
Yeah, if it's already out there, then fuck it.
So here is part of it.
Next week, I believe the search warrant that was executed at 621 Cherville Road will be made public. I don't know when that's going to happen, but I think it's likely to happen. And when you read the affidavit, it may be more clear to you why there was a search at 621 Cherville Road and some other locations. I think there will also be information in that search warrant that sadly will link a person to the circumstances of Aisha's disappearance that is no longer living. And it's very possible, not saying that the person that was named in the search warrant had anything to do with her disappearance, because I don't know any more than you do, or any more than the Sheriff's Department or the FBI or the SBI does. But it's very possible that that person, who's no longer here, has the answer as to what happened to Aisha. And the answer may very well never be known.
All right, so what are your thoughts on it? Because you haven't heard any part of that press conference before.
Well, clearly he's already trying to build a defense for his client, Roy, in which, I mean, I don't know how old Roy is. I'm sure that's something that we could.
He's about 80.
He's 80?
Yeah.
Okay. So is Roy's wife dead?
No, she's alive.
Do we know when Roy's dad died?
I mean, I would imagine a while ago.
I mean, because Aisha went missing
20 years ago. Yeah, I mean, that's very true.
So somebody that's no longer living, I mean, it seems to me that he's building a case to say that Roy wasn't the one that had anything to do with Aisha's disappearance, that this person that's now deceased might have had something to do with it. To me, it seems like he's just building a defense.
He absolutely is. And my impression when I listen to this, and I watched the entire press conference. This is just a snippet from it. But my impression was that Roy Dedman owned some property. He was an old man who like got caught up in whatever this is because, you know, his name's on the deed, but that this some other person was potentially the one responsible for Aisha's disappearance. And so I was like, man, that's kind of rough for him.
If that's true.
Right, exactly, right? But that was kind of the impression that guy was like, wow, it sounds like, because I had already looked up, you know, his age. So I knew he was like 80 years old. And so I was like, okay, you know. So I was expecting when the search warrants were released that it would, like you said, like lead just in a completely different direction based on what this attorney was saying. Well, the warrant applications were released the next Monday, and that's not exactly what happened.
Okay.
Instead of exculpating Roy Dedman, the warrant applications flat out named both him and his wife as suspects.
Mm-hmm.
But not only them. It also named two other people. Russell Bradley Underhill, a Vietnam veteran who was a patient at two care homes that the Dedmans owned, and Annalie Dedman Ramirez, Roy and Connie's daughter. She was 13 years old at the time of Aisha's disappearance.
Interesting.
So how did these people get named as suspects in the disappearance of Aisha Degree 24 years after she was last seen? DNA. At least DNA was the reason that Annalie Dedman Ramirez and Russell Underhill were named. So remember Aisha's backpack, the one that was double bagged in trash bags and found at a construction site?
Mm-hmm.
Well, they found Russell Underhill's DNA on the trash bag.
Interesting. How does that link back to their daughter?
Well, that doesn't link back to their daughter. So police didn't say what the DNA source was, like what type of DNA they found on the bag. So people are speculating that since it's a plastic bag, that it might have been touch DNA.
Sure.
That transferred over. But like I said, investigators have not specified. However, there was a second DNA match. According to the search warrant application, a quote, hair stem sample from Aisha Degree's undershirt, end quote, matched DNA from Anna Lee.
Remind me again, when was this backpack found?
2001.
2001.
Yeah.
So.
And Aisha went missing in 2000. Anna Lee was 13 years old in 2000.
Right. So what took them 23 years to get to this point?
Yeah, that's a good question. And that, unfortunately, I do not have the answer to.
I mean, I know getting DNA back is slow.
Yeah, not 23 years.
23 years. And yeah. It's not like the, I mean, in the past 23 years, yes, DNA technology has improved, but this technology was there then.
Well, so what I'm thinking, so touch DNA technology, you know, has improved a lot.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think it's very possible that, you know, in 2001, they couldn't have gotten the touch DNA if that's indeed what Russell Underhill's DNA was. In terms of the hair, Anna Lee wouldn't have been in CODIS. Like, so they could have run the DNA test and just had no idea who it belonged to.
Right. Had the sample, but yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
So fair. That's kind of what I'm thinking in terms of that. I'm thinking that they just couldn't get touch DNA and that they just didn't have a match for the hair.
Mm.
Like her basketball uniform, an undershirt belonging to Aisha being in the backpack was not a piece of information that the police released when they first told the public some of the items that were found in the backpack. And even now, they're still being vague, saying only that, quote, numerous items discovered in double-bagged backpack, including items belonging to Aisha and some not, end quote.
I mean, they're not going to play their hand if anything else in that bag implicates Anna Lee.
Yeah, exactly.
Or other suspects.
Yeah, and but, you know, I do think it's interesting that it said that the hair was found in Aisha's undershirt. And we didn't know about that. What we did know about was a New Kids on the Block t-shirt.
That was not Aisha's.
That was not Aisha's.
Right.
Because Aisha was only 9 years old in 2000, and New Kids on the Block were kind of like past their heyday.
A bit past, yeah.
Yeah. But Anna Lee's oldest sister was 16 in the year 2000. So she was born in the mid-80s.
Mm-hmm.
So like that makes it a little more plausible, you know, like that's closer to the right time frame.
Yeah.
Still a little bit past.
A little bit.
But I did find that interesting. Anna Lee's hair on Aisha's undershirt provides a direct link between the two girls, but how is that connected to her parents, Roy and Connie? The only two DNA results were for Anna Lee and Russell Underhill. Nothing for Roy and Connie on there, you know, that they've said. So remember, Anna Lee was only 13 in 2000. So while the DNA results make investigators believe that she is somehow involved in Aisha's disappearance, they don't think that a 13-year-old worked alone to create a 24-year-long mystery. In the probable cause affidavit, they state, on February 14th, 2000, the Dedman daughters were 16, 15, and 13. Due to the ages of the three daughters, quote, investigators believe adult assistance from Roy Dedman and Connie Dedman would have been necessary in the execution and or concealment of the crime, end quote.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense.
Yeah, and to be clear, they believe, and this is the first time they've ever said this, they believe that the crime in question is a homicide.
Mm-hmm.
Saying that in the past 24 years, there has been no sign of Aisha, despite, quote, technological advancements, social media platforms, and genealogical innovations, end quote. They go on to say, quote, based on these findings, investigators believe Aisha Degree is a victim of homicide with her body concealed, end quote. Speaking of genealogical innovations, that does appear to be what helped crack this case open in terms of the DNA. So going back to the PC affidavit, it says that various items from the backpack were sent for analysis and two returned evidentiary results. Genealogical data narrowed the samples down to two individuals. One belonged to Russell Bradley Underhill and one belonged to, quote, a hereditary family member of suspects Roy Lee Dedman and Connie Dedman, end quote. So I find that interesting because, I mean, they said Russell Underhill.
Right.
But Anna Lee has two sisters, Lizzie and Sarah, and the wording of that warrant seems to indicate that the hair could have belonged to any of them.
So how did they narrow it down to Anna Lee?
Right. Because so they must have had more of a reason to believe the sample belonged to Anna Lee, because three of those seven search warrants that were executed are for buckle swabs to collect DNA. They collected DNA from Roy, Connie, and Anna Lee, but not her two older sisters. So I'm wondering if this is like a 23andMe kind of situation, and maybe the sisters had submitted their DNA to one of those databases. And so this DNA came up as like a close match, but not a hit.
Not theirs. Yeah.
So they already knew
it wasn't
that it wasn't the two of them. And so maybe that just left Anna Lee.
Yeah, maybe.
And then they, of course, got her DNA to confirm it. But it is interesting because they must have been certain because, like, they said it belonged. It was her, yeah. You know?
Yeah. So you said when they towed the green car away that it had visible front end damage.
Yeah.
I know that the original description of the car was green that had rusted wheel wells.
Yeah.
Was there ever any description of front end damage before that?
No.
First, it's completely batshit crazy that they kept that car for 24 years.
What's completely batshit crazy is everything that they've kept for 24 years, which we'll get into when I go over what was seized.
Okay.
This seems like a family who has never thrown anything away ever in their entire lives.
I'm wondering if that front end damage has anything to do with it.
Hit and run is a big speculation that people have been making as well. And we'll get into that later. And so, as soon as people saw that front end damage, that's what a lot of people thought. Oh, and that was like one of the first like wild theories online was like drunk driving and, you know, like all this other stuff that has no basis in fact.
Yeah. I mean, the only thing with that front end damage and, you know, possible hit and run is they're implicating a 13-year-old. It's impossible that 13-year-olds could be driving, but that seems...
That 8-year-old went to Target last week.
Well, I know. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Like, it's totally possible that a 13-year-old could have taken a car at 4 in the morning for whatever reason, a joyride, whatever, and hit Aisha.
Yeah.
But then where do we go from there?
Well, it still doesn't answer the question of why
Aisha was walking down the side of the road to begin with.
No, it doesn't.
Why she left the house to begin with.
Yeah, and that's what I'm saying. Like, this is just, it gets crazier and crazier because it just leaves you with more questions.
And a 13-year-old and a 9-year-old, I mean, did they go to school together?
No. Okay, all right, but hold on. Okay. You're getting ahead of everything.
All right.
But let's talk about the sisters in general. So, like, no, they didn't go to school together. And obviously, they zoomed in on Anna Lee because of the DNA. Mm-hmm. But, like, you're right. I mean, out of a 16, 15, and 13-year-old, like the 13-year-old, that
wouldn't
seems
be
crazy.
The one you would think would be driving a car at 4 in the morning.
But that's not to say that Anna Lee's sisters don't have any connection to the case, because the other two are brought up in the warrants as well. On May 23rd, 2023, investigators interviewed an employee with Cleveland County Social Services. This person worked there back in 2000, and this is where we first learn about the connection between Russell Underhill and the Dedmans. Because don't forget about Russell Underhill. Like, his DNA was on the bag, too. And he's the, you know, deceased person that...
Yeah, I mean, in my mind, my thought process, and this is all theoretical, would be something like a hit and run. So for whatever reason, Anna Lee did something to Aisha. Parents got involved because she went and confessed to her parents. Her parents were like, well, who do we know that we need to cover this up? Who do we know that could dispose of a body? Oh, that crazy Vietnam vet that's in a couple of homes that we own.
Okay. Yes, we will get back to that.
That's all. Yeah. That's just me spitting in the wind.
I know. Put a pin in it, though. All right. So this employee who worked for social services visited Cleveland Healthcare often, and that's one of the health facilities owned by the Dedmans in 2000. And this person who the police interviewed could confirm that Russell Underhill was a resident there. This person also recalled Underhill being under Roy Dedman's care and said that they were told that Dedman would send his eldest daughter, Lizzie,
to transport patients in, quote, an unreliable vehicle, end quote, to and from Broughton Hospital in Morgantown, North Carolina.
An unreliable vehicle?
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't directly implicate a green
AMC Rambler, but it was like a 1964 AMC Rambler. When Cleveland Healthcare closed in 2002, Underhill was moved to the Deadman's other facility, Northbrook Rest Home, located in Vail, North Carolina. During the time that Underhill was under the Deadman's care, he listed Roy Deadman as his emergency contact on several different forms. There are a few pieces of information throughout these warrant applications that seem interesting, but that I can't necessarily connect to Aisha's case, except as I kind of wrote this episode out, I kind of did start to have a theory, which you just happened to touch on.
Okay.
So this is one seemingly random piece of information. On November 29th, 2002, Russell Underhill was reported missing. He was seen getting into a red truck driven by a white male. He was located 3 days later on December 2nd at Cleveland Healthcare in Shelby. So he left, got into a red truck, was gone for 3 days, and then just like showed up back home, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, Roy Underhill can't be interviewed about any possible connections or involvement because he has passed away.
Wait, when did you say he disappeared for those 3 days?
2002.
Okay, so after
the backpack.
Okay.
So he was last seen at his home on Christmas Day, 2004, and was found dead, like sitting in his chair a couple days later.
Okay.
And the cause of his death was undetermined. He had a lot of things wrong with him, I guess, health-wise, but like they couldn't really determine which one of these things could have possibly killed him.
Okay.
It's so weird. It's all really strange. So now we know that Lizzie transported patients, including Underhill, to the hospital during the time period when Aisha went missing. Interestingly, that hospital is only 7.2 miles away from where Aisha's backpack was discovered.
Mm-hmm.
And that could obviously be a coincidence, but it does bring everything a little bit closer to that backpack, which was 25 miles away from where Aisha was last seen.
Right.
All right, so that's Lizzie, and we've talked about Annalise, so what about Sarah, the middle sister? On September 10th, Sarah Gwen Capel, the middle daughter, was interviewed. She stated that she drove a 1964 AMC Rambler when she was 16, given to her by Roy Deadman in 1999. This car is similar to the one described by witnesses and was the one located at 601 Cherryville Road.
So it's the middle child's
car. Yeah.
Okay, but they didn't implicate her in the affidavit.
No, her saying that the AMC Rambler that they towed away was her car is the only time that she's mentioned in this. And the only time Lizzie's mentioned is when
driving
it says that
an unreliable car.
Driving an unreliable car, transporting patients to that hospital 7 miles away from where the backpack was found.
Right.
And then Anna Lee was really, you know, I mean, her big thing was obviously the DNA.
Yeah.
Pretty big.
Kind of a big deal.
So let's talk about the property searches and what was recovered. As I mentioned, there are 7 warrants total, and 4 of them are for properties owned by the Deadman family. First of all, it should be mentioned that Roy and Connie Deadman own at least a dozen properties in and around Shelby, North Carolina. They also have a large number of vehicles. Roy Deadman has 29 vehicles registered in his name.
Okay.
601 Cherryville Road, which is where the Rambler was towed from, is owned by Roy and Connie, but it's been a rental property for at least the last 5 years. Despite this, Roy has left a large amount of personal property in and around the home, including that car.
Mm-hmm.
The current tenant, whose name has been redacted, told investigators that there are 3 rooms in the home that are locked with padlocks. This person was told by Roy Deadman that the rooms contain his personal belongings.
All right. That's weird in and of itself.
Yeah.
Like, I would never enter into any rental agreement where the owner was like, padlocking doors saying, don't go in there.
Yeah, no joke. Like, I mean, it's one thing to rent an Airbnb and like they have a locked owner's closet.
Yeah.
But like this dude's been living there for 5 years.
Yeah.
And it's three rooms.
Right. I mean, that's the kind of stuff of horror movies.
Absolutely. So luckily, nothing terrifying like that was found, but police took a lot out of this house. And the search warrant did allow for the police to enter locked rooms and any safes that happened to be on the premises. So, you know, that wasn't an issue. In their search, they seized the following items: two disposable cameras, film, micro VHS tapes, flip phone, Lizzie Deadman's journal, Anna Lee Deadman's journals, plural, DSS complaint documents, transport logs, the 1964 green AMC Rambler, documents containing Russell Underhill's name, black trash bag, Carhartt jeans, children's clothing, a silver cell phone, and a .22 caliber rifle.
When I hear that there was video taken as evidence.
VHS tapes.
Yeah, that doesn't leave a warm and fuzzy feeling inside.
Now, obviously, these are just VHS tapes, so that they didn't know what was on them. I mean, they just grabbed them. So it could just be nothing. It could be like old soap operas that they taped.
Sure.
Now, in addition, another Deadman family, someone by the name of Laura Deadman, was interviewed on September 10th. She told investigators that several years ago, she saw Roy Deadman digging a chest-deep hole on the property. And we're still talking about 601 Cherryville. On September 11th, 2024, while the search warrant was being executed, the investigator observed a 6 to 8 inch dent in the ground where it was obvious that the ground had been disturbed. We know that ground penetrating radar was brought out, which is used to discover human remains. But remember, the sheriff's department did state that no human remains were found. So I'm not sure what was done about that dent in the ground. So I don't know if they used the ground penetrating radar on that or if they actually dug. A search warrant was also executed at 621 Cherryville Road, which is where Roy Deadman currently lives. So this is just, you know, right down the road. He and Connie, while still married, no longer reside in the same home. 621 Cherryville Road is 3.7 miles from where Aisha was last seen in the vicinity of Highway 18 and Wallace Grove Drive. And I believe that in 2000, that was the Deadman family home, 621 Cherryville. The property is massive, totaling nearly 11 acres, and Roy Deadman also owns some nearby and adjoining parcels. Deadman had several vehicles on this property, including three green vehicles and one red truck.
Are you kidding me?
Nope.
So the red truck goes back to Underhill.
Right.
When he went missing.
Mm-hmm.
Three other green vehicles.
And they don't give any details
on them. But we know that they weren't seized.
Yeah, no, it doesn't appear that, yeah, any other vehicles were seized other than the AMC Rambler. So here's the list of items that investigators did seize. 5 laptops and 2 desktop computers, 2 digital cameras and a disposable camera, a notebook, an SD card in an envelope labeled September to November 2020, multiple cell phones, including iPhones and flip phones, a smartwatch, paperwork from DHHS, which is the Department of Health and Human Services, a human tooth in a Ziploc bag, VHS tapes, a cassette tape, digital photos, a blue notebook with vehicle registrations, 12 Oaks financial records from 2000, a small piece of red fabric from outside, and a small shoe sole from outside.
Hmm. Again, they obviously haven't searched any of these items, like the digital photos or the...
More VHS tapes.
More VHS tapes or the computers or anything like that, but it does not leave me with a warm and fuzzy feeling inside.
As I was going through these evidence lists, I was just thinking like hoarders, like they've just never thrown away anything. But an 80-year-old man with 5 laptops and 2 desktop computers in his home, what is that?
I don't know. It's not making me feel good though. I mean, the human tooth in a Ziploc bag, like
I'm just going to assume that's a baby tooth.
Could be one of his kids.
Like I'm just praying that that is one of his kids' baby teeth.
Yeah. But they don't know, which is probably why they took it.
Well, yeah, of course. And as we learned from last week's story, Katia Line, you can extract DNA from baby teeth.
Mm-hmm.
The two Cherryville Road properties are where police gathered the majority of their evidence. However, they did also visit 5106 Hawthorne Lane, which is Connie Dedman's current residence. This property is only about half an acre. And from here, they seized a Samsung Galaxy tablet, a flash drive containing photos, a Dell computer, a laptop, an external hard drive, a digital camera, a floppy disk, assorted CDs, and assorted SD cards.
I mean, this family is hoarders, but they're hoarders of digital technology.
Yeah, right?
Like, who has all of that?
And again, I mean, I don't know Connie's age, but, you know, Roy's 80, so she's probably around that age. And she has two computers and a Galaxy tablet and an external hard drive. Like, that's pretty, that's a lot of tech.
External hard drive, like, plus two other computers. Like, what is she storing?
I don't know. Finally, investigators went to 7426 Walnut Wood Drive in Charlotte, North Carolina, where Annalee lives with her husband, Victor Ramirez. They got the DNA sample from her and executed a search warrant for the home. The only item seized, however, was a BlackBerry cell phone.
A BlackBerry?
A BlackBerry! So that's what I'm saying. Like, these people just keep everything.
That's weird.
Yes. Police are now in possession of a great deal of physical evidence, but what it will show remains to be seen. It's also hard to really come up with a theory of the crime based on what we've learned from these warrants. The police state that the Dedman family has no known connection to the DeGree family. So it doesn't seem as though they believe that any member of the family, like, groomed Aisha and got her to leave the house that morning. Because that's been my theory, that Aisha was told by someone she trusted
to leave the house
and to meet up with them, and they were going to go do something fun or do something for her parents' anniversary or whatever. That's always what I thought happened. But the DeGrees did not know this family. Like, police have not uncovered any connection. So it's like, no, Annalee wasn't on her basketball team, or, right, you know, they didn't go to the same school, they didn't go to the same church, nothing like that.
There's got to be some connection.
Right. But, you know,
but maybe not for grooming purposes.
Yeah.
Whatever the connection is.
I don't know. But I mean, but that was stated in the probable cause affidavit, that there was no known connection between these two families. All right. Let's get back to talking about theories, though. One popular theory is that one of the sisters, probably Lizzie, since she was the oldest, was driving in the storm that morning and hit Aisha. Maybe, you know, transporting a patient, maybe not, maybe transporting Russell Underhill, maybe not. Then she panicked and took Aisha back to their home, where one or both of her parents helped her cover up the little girl's death. But we've already talked about why, like, the hit and run kind of doesn't make a lot of sense. But also, the probable cause affidavit states, quote, Aisha DeGree was seen being pulled into a 1970s green Lincoln, Thunderbird, or another similar vehicle. Aisha Jaquilla DeGree has not been seen since that time, end quote. Pulled in,
mm-hmm,
evokes an action that to me is not consistent with hitting somebody who is walking on the side of the road.
Right.
That sounds more like an abduction.
Yeah. Because it's not it's not getting into a car either.
Mm-mm. Or being carried into a car.
Right. So it's not like they pulled over and said, do you need a ride?
Right.
And she got in.
Yeah. The people who she was planning on meeting in the first place and said, hey, I'm here, let's go.
Yeah. Those words are very specifically used.
That's what I'm saying. And a hit and run, you know, doesn't answer the main question, is why does she pack her backpack and leave her home in the middle of a rainstorm at, you know, 4 a.m. So as for Russell Underhill, my personal theory is basically what you were getting at earlier, that he wasn't actually involved in Aisha's initial abduction or her death necessarily, because of the information about him going missing in 2002 that was included in this, despite seemingly having nothing to do with Aisha's disappearance. I mean, they wouldn't have just stuck that in there for no reason.
Right.
So that makes me think that he was more of an accessory after the fact. When Paul Flores was on trial for murdering Kristen Smart, the prosecution alleged that he and his family moved Kristen's body a few times in order to avoid detection. Could that have been what happened here? Could the 3 days that Underhill, quote, went missing and the chest deep hole Laura Dedman saw Roy Dedman digging be related to each other and possibly an attempt to further conceal Aisha's body? I think that what you were saying before can go kind of hand in hand with this theory that I'm saying now. And I think that you're absolutely right. Like maybe something happened and they thought, okay, who can help us with this?
Right. And it was Underhill.
Yeah. Back in 2000.
Yeah.
And then in 2002, for whatever reason, they felt that they needed to move her. And so they brought Underhill to help with that again.
So this is after the backpack had been found.
Right.
Is it close to when the backpack was found?
No, it's about a year and a half later.
Well, I'm wondering if whatever was going on with the case that obviously has not been made public, that they were thinking that maybe investigators were getting close.
Yeah, I think maybe something spooked them.
And maybe they moved her off of his property, off of not just that property, but like moved her off of property that he owns.
Yeah, maybe.
That would be my thought.
Or maybe just, yeah, it could be all the way off of his property. Or like I said, he owns over a dozen properties, some of which are empty lots.
Mm.
So it could have been something like that as well.
Yeah, I mean, maybe that was when they were getting ready to rent that house.
Oh, yeah, 601 Cherryville.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe.
Maybe that's why they wanted to move her.
Yeah. I have to think that that whole him going missing for 3 days is in there for a reason. Especially when he was seen getting into a red truck and then they mentioned the red truck at 621 Cherryville.
Yeah, but they didn't seize that truck.
Yeah, and so, of course, this is just a theory. And it's probably going to be a while before we get any definitive answers regarding any of the Dedman family's potential involvement in Aisha DeGree's disappearance. However, there is one thing that investigators wanted to make certain the public knew. That Aisha's immediate family is not involved in whatever happened to her. In the probable cause affidavit, they state, quote, all information pertaining to and obtained from Aisha DeGree's immediate and extended family indicates her family does not know her whereabouts nor have had any type of contact with her since her disappearance 24 years ago, end quote.
Well, it's good that they put that out there to squash any possible rumors about that.
Oh, because there have been a ton.
Oh, I'm sure.
If you look up Aisha's case basically anywhere on the internet, you will see people speculating horrible things about her parents.
Yeah.
Her family has been desperately searching for her for over 2 decades. Their life was irrevocably changed on February 14th, 2000. Hopefully, this new evidence will not only bring them closer to finding answers about Aisha, but will help them clear their name as well. Aisha Jaquilla DeGree has been missing from Shelby, North Carolina since February 14th, 2000. She's a black female with black hair and pigtails and brown eyes. She was approximately 4'6" and 60 pounds at the time of her disappearance. She was last seen wearing a white nightshirt with a teddy bear on the front and white size 3 Nike tennis shoes. She was carrying a black backpack. Aisha was 9 years old when she went missing. She would be 34 today. Anyone with information on the disappearance of Aisha DeGree is asked to call the Cleveland County Sheriff's Office at 704-484-4788 or the FBI at 704-672-6100. There's a $45,000 reward for information that can solve this case. You can see all of the sources for this episode along with photos and videos at our website, andthentheyweregone.com.
And be sure to follow us on social, And Then They Were Gone Pod on Facebook and at ATTWG Pod on Instagram and TikTok. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe and consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. It will help new listeners find us. And the more people that listen, the more chances we have of bringing someone home.
And we'll see you here next week for a brand new episode.
See you next week.
And Then They Were Gone is hosted by Kona Gallagher and Ethan Flick. All research, writing, and editing is done by me, Kona Gallagher. Theme music is The Stork by Ketsa. Additional music is provided by Kai Engel. And Then They Were Gone is a Little Monster production.
Hey, you can do it!